Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brookmarkle, and coming up on the program, courageous journalist Mabel Norris Reese challenged the racist Sheriff Willis McCall in the mid-20th century.
I think the turning point for her, because she covered the first trial, was the shooting of the Groveland boys in 1951 as they were waiting for the second trial.
We'll discuss Howard Kester and the lynching of Claude Neal.
The violence and brutality described by observers and participants in the horrific spectacle lynching was and remains deeply troubling.
And we'll talk about advice columnist Dorothy Ricker. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers.
Say what you want to say.
Brave, heroic, and fearless are just some of the words used to describe journalist Mabel Norris Reese, recipient of the first National Courage in Journalism Award in 1956. She fought for social justice while facing threats and intimidation from the racist Lake County Sheriff Willis McCall and his enablers in the Ku Klux Klan. Gilbert King, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Devil in the Grove and Beneath a Ruthless Sun, says that Mabel Norris Reese was owner and editor of the Mount Dora Topic beginning in 1947.
They'd have these pool of reporters at the press conference, and she was the only woman. So she was in with the Sentinel, the Daily Commercial, the Leesburg, all these newspapers, but she's really the only woman. And not only that, but she actually runs her own newspaper. So she had a lot more freedom than some of these guys that she's working with. But I just found it really fascinating to see her trying to negotiate this man's world, this club, where these male journalists were kind of like protecting the status quo a little bit more. And Mabel had a little bit more autonomy, and she could actually write about what she wanted. So it's really an interesting dynamic to see something in the 40s and this woman who's running the newspaper and just be thrust into these major stories.
Cindy Erickson remembers Mabel Norris Reese as a crusader for justice and as a grandmother.
I remember her as actually being very nurturing. I lost my first tooth at her house and was petrified the tooth fairy wouldn't be able to find me. So she made a phone call, which I assumed was to the tooth fairy, to tell the tooth fairy where I was. When I was in third grade, we had desegregation of the schools, and she had me write a letter to the editor about there's nothing wrong with us being desegregated, and I don't know what all the hoopla is about. So she definitely pushed me to be aware of what was going on and to be aware of racial tensions and to just stand up for what was right. And she'd push real hard for that, even when she was being very nurturing. There were still the suggestions, you need to do this. And if the gentle push didn't work, she could get much more forceful, because she felt so strongly.
Just a couple of years after Mabel Norris Reese began reporting on events in Central Florida, the infamous Groveland rape trial began. Gilbert King.
The Groveland case started in Lake County in 1949. It was a young woman and her husband, who she was separated from at the time, went out on a date to try to get their marriage back together. And something happened alongside of the road. The next thing we know, she made the claim that she had been abducted and sexually assaulted by four African Americans. This brought the Klan in, started burning down African American homes. It became a powder keg. A really big trial happened like a little bit more than a month later, involved Thurgood Marshall. So this became a very big civil rights case focused in Central Florida at the time.
Ben Green is author of the book Before His Time, The Untold Story of Harry T. Moore, America's First Civil Rights Martyr.
In 1949, I don't think anyone is still certain what happened on this night with the Paget couples, Willie and Norma Paget, a young couple who had separated. They got back together to go to a square dance. And on the way home, something happened. They claimed that she had been attacked by four young black men and carried off and raped. They claimed they were nowhere around. Regardless, all hell broke loose in Groveland. There were several nights of rioting, Klansmen caravanning through Groveland, shooting up the black community. The entire black population of Groveland was evacuated to Orlando. A couple houses were burned down. Of the four Groveland suspects, one of them was shot and killed before trial. Three of them went to trial and were convicted. Harry Moore got involved in it from the very beginning. As soon as they were arrested, he sent a young attorney to Rayford to interview the defendants and came back with a story saying they had just been beaten mercilessly. They'd been hung over a water pipe in the Lake County Jail, and Willis McCall's deputies beat them with rubber hoses. Those beatings were then documented by the FBI and by the NAACP National Office. So he was involved in it. He was calling it a travesty of justice from the very beginning.
Harry T. Moore contacted Mabel Norris Reese, asking her to write about how Sheriff McCall was mishandling the Groveland case. Bill Gary is president of the Harry T. and Harriet V. Moore Cultural Complex.
Four young men from the Groveland, Florida area, was accused of raping this young white woman. There was a trial held, defendants were convicted, but then there was evidence introduced that there was going to have a retrial, and supposedly the sheriff of Lake County, Willis McCall, was transporting two of the defendants from one jail to another. And along the way, something happened. The two defendants ended up being shot, one being killed. The sheriff's account of that was they tried to escape, although they were handcuffed and shackled, which kind of makes it hard to believe.
Mabel Norris Reese had initially supported Sheriff McCall in her articles, but it was the shooting of Walter Irvin and the killing of Sam Shepard while in McCall's custody that was a turning point for her. Gilbert King.
She came down here, I think she wanted to buy into the community, reporting on a lot of community news, Little League scores, Northerners who were coming back down to Mount Dora. And I think she was friends with the prosecutor, Jesse Hunter, and helped her get into the world of Sheriff Willis McCall. And I think she was a little bit naive and sort of thought that racially that this was an idyllic place when it clearly was not. And I think the turning point for her, because she covered the first trial, was the shooting of the Groveland boys in 1951 as they were waiting for the second trial. The prosecutor, Jesse Hunter, at that point said, I don't think that that was an escape attempt. I think it was deliberate. Mabel had a lot of communications, and that was really her turning point. And I noticed if you look at her career, from that moment on, and it was like November 1951, she was all about justice. And justice didn't sell in a small town newspaper. That's not what people really wanted to hear about, white supremacy. And so you could see as she got her courage and as she found her sort of inspiration about the things to write about, the things that really interested her, she's also facing the backlash in her own community. And I thought that was a really powerful thing that she just continued to do it, knowing that it was going to hurt her pocketbook, as she said.
Bill Gary.
Harry T. Moore got involved in that case, went and tried to get statements of anybody that knew about it from the surviving witness themselves. And he called on the governor of Florida, wrote letters to the Justice Department calling for the suspension and the charging of murder of Sheriff Willis McCall. Now, some contend that because Willis McCall was such a powerful sheriff back then, and as you know, in the state of Florida, sheriffs generally have a lot of power there. They feel that he had some part in either the planning or the implementation of Harry Moore's ultimate death.
After the initial conviction, the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall appealed the death sentences of Walter Irvin and Sammy Shepard.
Ben Green.
Their convictions were overturned by the Supreme Court. A new trial was scheduled. The day of a hearing for the new trial, Willis McCall and his deputy went to Rayford to pick him up. On the way back to Lake County, claimed that the two prisoners jumped him and attacked him, and he shot him. He emptied his revolver into him. He killed Sam Shepard, mortally, seriously, critically wounded Walter Irvin, who did survive, and told a completely different story, which is that McCall just yanked him out and started shooting. At that point, Harry T. Moore started calling for McCall to be removed from office, indicted for murder. He's telegramming and writing letters to the governor, to the U.S. attorney, to Thurgood Marshall, to the FBI. And then just 6 weeks later, he was blown up in his house. So the morning after the bombing in Mims, people immediately connected the Groveland case to the Moore bombing. And when the FBI agents and the local deputies worked their way through the crowd that had gathered and said, why would anyone have wanted to kill Harry Moore? Everybody immediately said, Groveland.
Mabel Norris Reese was not killed for her efforts on behalf of racial justice as Harry T. and Harriet V. Moore were. She did, however, face an ongoing campaign of intimidation. Gilbert King.
She started writing about the support of the Brown versus Board decision, which was not a very popular decision in the South. But she was writing about saying, we need to make this work. We need to be patient. This is the right thing to do. And that was when the trouble started. You know, the white supremacists started like bombing her house, poisoned her dog. They defaced her office right up the street, just, you know, vandalized it, wrote KKK all over it. And the final turning point, which is just bizarre to me, is some white supremacists opened up a rival newspaper in Mount Dora, as if Mount Dora needed a second newspaper. And basically Willis McCall went around and just threatened all of Mabel's advertisers. And that was it. They had no choice. Willis McCall was the most powerful person in Lake County and basically just ran her out of town, ran her out of the county.
Mabel Norris Reese continued to fight for social justice from the relative safety of the Daytona Beach News Journal. Many of her award-winning articles gained national recognition. Her granddaughter, Cindy Erickson, says that Mabel remained politically engaged until the end of her life on January 1, 1995.
She was always on top of politics and what was going on. Even when she got older after she'd retired, when C-SPAN came out on cable, my grandmother was the happiest person. She always had that on, would always talk politics. She lost her sight to macular degeneration, but still was on top of everything that was going on. And you couldn't go to her house without having a discussion about what was going on in the world, ever.
A lot of progress has been made to address the types of civil rights violations and social justice issues that Mabel Norris Reese wrote about, but there is still a long way to go. Bill Gary.
It would be nice if we had come to that point where events of that nature were really just a memory, that they were part of history and whatever. It is not. And we have to recognize the reality of the time, that there's still a lot of work to be done.
To find out more about the life and work of journalist Mabel Norris Reese, watch Florida Frontier's television episode 51. Check your local PBS schedule or watch it anytime at myfloridahistory.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org, where you can find new books on Florida history and culture, register for the upcoming Florida Historical Society annual meeting and symposium, October 20th and 21st at the University of Central Florida, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org.
Southern trees bear strange fruit.
Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, the lynching of Claude Neal, a black farm worker outside the Jackson County rural town of Greenwood on October 26, 1934, is viewed as one of the most brutal examples in the history of lynching from the Jim Crow era.
The violence and brutality described by observers and participants in the horrific spectacle lynching of Claude Neal, a 23-year-old wage-earning farm worker who was accused of the rape and murder of Lola Kennedy, the 20-year-old daughter of his white employer, was and remains deeply troubling. Friends since childhood, Neal was arrested on circumstantial evidence. Sheriff Flake Chambliss first housed him in the nearby Chipley Jail before moving him first to Panama City, then Pensacola, and finally Brewton, Alabama, as public anger increased. A reported 100 local men drove to the Alabama jail and brought him back to Jackson County, where he was tortured for 10 to 12 hours before being lynched. His body was dragged behind an automobile and made available for further abuse by the crowd of men, women, and children, estimated in the thousands. As had been the case for other lynchings in the 1920s and 1930s, modern technology operated to incite emotions and enlarge the crowd. Newspapers and radio carried information about the upcoming event and encouraged attendance. Railroads ran special trains, and automobiles brought people from multiple states to express their fury and act out their brutality. The summer 2007 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly contained an article by then Florida State University PhD student Joshua Youngblood, who connected the lynching of Claude Neal with Depression-era civil rights activities and leftist efforts to effect economic justice. His analysis relies primarily on the investigative report of Christian socialist Howard Kester, who undertook an inquiry into the events at the behest of the NAACP. An experienced activist who had worked in Arkansas and Tennessee, he wrote to a friend that after his experiences in Marianna, quote, "Scarcely have I ever had a more devastating experience than that. The lynching and the subsequent developments are among the most ghastly things in all the long history of lynching. My nerves are frayed. I was warned to get out before it was too late. I was physically tired to death, and my spirits were never at a lower ebb."
And Connie, entering a community to investigate a brutal lynching like this required enormous courage. What prepared Kester for this undertaking?
Howard Kester, a socialist and seminary-trained minister, had spent more than a decade fighting for social and racial justice as part of a group of black and white Southerners who presented an increasingly vocal opposition to racial segregation and economic injustice. Many of them, including Kester, were influenced by the social gospel teachings of the Progressive Era and the writings of Reinhold Niebuhr, a professor at Union Theological Seminary, whose Christian realism influenced a generation of American leaders, including Jimmy Carter and Martin Luther King Jr. Kester saw his Christian mission as that of working with the poor and oppressed, and to that end, he had labored on behalf of coal miners in Appalachia and sharecroppers in Mississippi and Arkansas before volunteering to investigate the lynching of Claude Neal. Youngblood grounded his analysis of the investigation in the historiography of race and social and economic justice that emerged over an extended period from the 1960s through the early 21st century, including several books and academic articles on the evolution of lynching violence from secrecy to spectacle. Youngblood highlights two separate social justice efforts associated with the Jackson County events. One by the Florida women members of the ASWPL, who called upon Governor David Shultz to send the state militia to Jackson County before the lynching and to prevent the killing of Claude Neal. Shultz had previously made a campaign promise that there would be no lynchings in Florida during his administration. Mrs. William P. Cornell telegraphed the governor on the day of the lynching, pleading with him to, quote, "remember his words," end quote, and honor his pledge. The militia was sent to Jackson County, but on the day after the lynching, to restore order and prevent an escalation of violence. The NAACP also wired the governor to protect Neal's mother and aunt, who were in police custody as accessories to the murder. They remained in jail for several weeks before being released without charges. The second effort by activists analyzed by Youngblood was, of course, Kester's investigation and the publication of his report by the NAACP. Kester's investigation, quote, "uncovered clear evidence that Claude Neal's lynching had been both planned by the perpetrators and anticipated by local authorities," end quote. His report also included observations by locals that the lynching and subsequent violence made clear the economic tensions that had been simmering for months, as the Depression pitted blacks and poor whites against one another for scarce jobs as employers turned to cheaper black workers during hard times. Kester also learned that the black community was rife with rumors that Neal and Kennedy were engaged in a sexual relationship and that Neal killed her when she threatened to expose his actions, an act that should have been handled within the justice system, not with the brutality of the lynch mob. Finally, the investigation exposed the general support for the lynching among white Floridians. One woman forwarded a letter to Governor Shultz that she had sent to Mrs. Cornell, in which she chided Cornell, quote, "Wake up! Let Southern lynch law or otherwise take its course in regard to such criminals. Stand firm with white supremacy, right or wrong," end quote. On the federal level, the Justice Department did not investigate potential kidnapping charges against the mob that had moved Neal across state lines for the purpose of killing him. Nor did the federal Wagner-Costigan anti-lynching bill, introduced in January 1934, advance. No federal anti-lynching bill would be entered into law until 2022, when the Emmett Till anti-lynching law unanimously passed the U.S. Senate and was signed into law.
And unfortunately, Florida had the highest number of per capita lynchings of any southern state. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
He is a strange and bitter cry.
This is Florida Frontiers. Holly Baker recently spoke with author Kimberly Voss about Winter Park Advice columnist Dorothy Ricker.
Dr. Kimberly Voss is a tenured professor of journalism at the University of Central Florida in Orlando. She's also the author of several books, including Reevaluating Women's Page Journalism in the Post-World War II Era, Celebrating Soft News. She told me about newspaper columnist Dorothy Ricker of Tampa and her weekly syndicated advice column, Teenage Mail, which ran in newspapers across the country from 1952 to 1984.
Most, if not all, newspapers had advice columns almost since the beginning of the 1900s, almost always written by women. And they're fascinating to look at because it really was a time in the early years that you might not ask your mom or your family or a friend. It might have been kind of embarrassing, or you were worried about your relationship with that person. But people would write in to newspapers with incredible questions and comments. And it really was a matter of communication back and forth. And I think most of us are familiar with the national ones, you know, your Dear Abby's or Ann Landers and that sort of thing that were nationally syndicated in the big papers. But every newspaper also had a smaller kind of advice column that was like specific to their community. So like there was a problem in, say, Tampa or Miami or Orlando, you would ask specifically kind of about those issues. And so the advice becomes very much about the times.
Dorothy Ricker's advice column appeared in major Florida newspapers such as the Tampa Tribune and the Miami Herald, and would go on to be carried by dozens of other newspapers across the country.
Dorothy Ricker, she was a syndicated columnist for 30 years. This is 1952 to 1984. So if you think about the social changes of that time, that's a lot. And she was one of the few that were aimed at teenagers. And this was also a time period where teenagers weren't, in their interests or concerns, weren't always taken seriously. And that's one of the things I loved about Dorothy. She cared about the folks that wrote into her. And she treated them like their teenage issues were as important as an adult issue, which was so ahead of its time and so lovely. So she had this newspaper column that was syndicated. But one of the things I loved about her was even if the letter didn't get published, she would still respond to that teenager in a personal letter, which I just think how much that must have mattered to a teenager who was writing in, that someone took the time to say your concerns matter.
Dorothy Ricker's advice column tackled issues common to most teenagers, such as dating, friendship, and dealing with parents.
A lot of the questions, not surprisingly, had to do with dating. And they often had to do with the expectations of gender at the time. Were they allowed to like someone that their friend liked? Was it okay to be the one to ask a boy out? And so many of this, I feel like we could talk about this today with young people. It's universal about particularly girls and friendships where somebody's shunning them. Those were 1950s questions that work today, you know, at any middle school or high school, I'm sure. And so that was the universal part of these questions. But she was also very matter of fact, very common sense, and often very funny. And that's not an easy tone to pull off. And she did this very, very well in dealing with the kinds of things that are both everyday, but very important. There was a lot of those parental questions of things that mom and dad said you couldn't do that the teens felt were, you know, out of tune with their generation, which I think still happens today.
As Dr. Voss explains, even though Dorothy Ricker was an important voice in the community, very little is known about her life beyond her advice column.
Dorothy was also very much a community speaker, which was common for advice columnists because you got kind of famous locally or nationally because your stuff was in the newspaper and they saw your picture, your byline. And so she would speak particularly in Florida. She spoke a lot in Miami and Tampa. And so you became just not even just a newspaper columnist, but the voice of your community that people could go and talk to and see. And that was amazing to me. I have limited information about Dorothy's background, which is also kind of a sad part of, I think, newspapers consolidating and people retiring and that sort of thing, that all of a sudden institutional memory is gone. Dorothy was born in Maine. She moved to Tampa in 1952 with her husband. And then about 8 years before she died, she moved to Winter Park. We don't know much more about her other than that she was married and she had a child and then grandchildren. And I don't know her educational background or even how she necessarily got to Florida other than moving with her husband. And that's kind of the challenge of studying these women. They were so important to their communities, in her case, to the state and across the country, you know, 30 years of syndication to dozens of newspapers. And the only real story about her is her obituary that ran in the Orlando Sentinel because she died in Winter Park. Advice columnists helped so many people, and yet they're kind of marginalized because they didn't cover, say, politics, right? Or write editorial stuff. And they did matter. They mattered a lot to their readers. And you can tell by the kinds of things they sent in. And like I said, the fact that Dorothy didn't just write her column, she answered every single letter. I mean, that's a lot of work. And that had to mean a lot to those readers.
For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week and visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by John White. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brookmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund, and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.